Hey, Elliot.
Hey, Brian.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Banana Chan. She is a game designer and co-founder of Read Write Memory, formerly Game in a Curry, known for such games as Zhangshi, Blood in the Banquet Hall, Deimos Academy, The Revenant Society, and Forgery, just to name a few. You can find their writings in Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft, Betrayal at House on the Hill, and Kids on Bikes modules such as Dads on Mowers, just to name a few of those. They are a multi-Emmy Award winner and 2022's Designer of the Year for Dicebreakers Tabletop Awards. Welcome to the table, Banana Chan. It is so wonderful to have you here.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
How are you doing?
I am good. It's Monday. Very excited to chat with both of you.
We love a Monday chat. So what we like to do at the top of all of our conversations is kind of lay out what the goal is, or sort of the central questions that we're trying to get at. So we really wanted to talk to you because you've made a career in sort of capital G games at large, tabletop role-playing, board games, LARPs, and you founded a company within the industry. And so I have recently made the perhaps ill-advised decision to quit my day job and focus full-time on games. And so I'm hoping to pick at your brain a little bit about your career in games, the advice you have, what you've learned, and how these sort of three kinds of games interplay. Does that sound like a plan?
Yeah, that sounds great to me. Where should we start?
and just for the audience and for Banana, that's true as of today, Elliot?
It's true as of today. Today is my first official day not working for my job anymore. Yeah, just working God. For me.
Congratulations. Yeah. That's huge.
Thank you. I'm very excited.
Good for you.
So I guess where we start, I'd love to kind of start in this idea of thinking about these three kinds of games that you work on, board games, tabletop role-playing games, and LARPs. I just was reading through Suburban Consumption of the Monstrous, which is a delight. Is there a difference for you in working these three kinds of games?
Yeah, I would say that the mindset going in is very different for all three, but the way that we iterate on those different types of games, I feel like it's pretty much the same in terms of when it comes to, drafting the first iteration of the game, iterating on the game, doing play testing, development. Those kinds of design cycles are kind of similar. It's just that the way that I usually approach each one can look a little bit different. So broad strokes, yes, they're kind of much the same, but when it comes to a more micro level, it's like, they're pretty different.
So how do you maybe approach these differently, first from a creative perspective and then maybe secondly from a business perspective, each of those in turn?
Yeah, so I think I start thinking about who the audience is for. And so when it comes to something that's like a little bit more niche, a little bit, weirder, it's typically made for me because I really enjoy strange, weird movies, more experimental books. I really enjoy weird LARPs, things that are typically a little bit, I would say more theatrical and harder to explain to another person, hey, this is a LARP that we're going to play that's going to be about feelings and terrible people and sabotage, versus if I were to design a board game or work with a group that's going to be designing mechanics for a board game, the audience for that is typically of two types, right? So the first type is the hobbyist, right? The hobbyist that goes to the board game store, purchases a game. This is something that they're excited for. The other type would be for mass market. And so mass market's also very different from the hobbyist. And so it's just keeping in mind, who's the audience, who are we designing for, and what are we making?
I like that answer because it's kind of a creative and business answer, audience is both.
Yeah, it really is.
And do you think across all of these three, all these different mediums, do you have a singular ethos that you kind of bring to all of them? Is there a thing that you look at of, this is the type of thing I want to do, and this is when I think I've accomplished it?
Yeah, so I think that, as an artist, as a person who does creative stuff, I think that there is never this idea of I'm done with something. I feel like at the point when something is done is when you're just like, okay, I've hit that deadline. We're done here. This is done.
Yeah, it's done when it's due.
Yeah, I have to be done.
Exactly. But in my mind, I think that if I were to return back to, like, you know, an older iteration of a game that's already been published, I'd be like, well, why don't we just, like, update this and edit this and, like, you know, make a new version. So I think that when it comes to, like, completing something, it's hard to say, like, when something is done. But when it comes to, like, my philosophy on games and, like, game design, I think that having a more holistic approach is always good. So, like, thinking about, like, you know, why are you creating something? What is the theme? And how do the mechanics and the theme, you know, marry one another? And how does it make sense in this universe that you're creating?
For most of your stuff, because I've kind of found it, I guess this, I can already guess that the answer is probably this varies by project, but do you find yourself starting more from a theme or from a mechanics perspective?
You're correct in assuming that it depends on the project.
But yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I prefer theme first because that's something for me to latch onto. I'm like a very visual person. And so if I can sort of imagine it happening in my mind in terms of like a theme, then it's easier for me to create mechanics based around that. And I think that, you know, that sort of goes back to the holistic approach where it's just like, you know, if you have a theme that makes sense with these sets of mechanics, then why not go ahead and like create a prototype based around that?
I think the other thing that's kind of interesting when looking at your sort of body of work, Banana, is that it seems like these worlds are informing each other in a lot of situations for you. Like Jiangxia had sort of board game elements to its production, same with Revenant Society. I'm curious, like, is this box game trend one that you think is like one that we're moving more into? Is it one that you like creating within? Like, I'm just kind of curious your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I would say that I enjoy creating. I would enjoy, like, you know, designing around sort of like a box set with board game elements. I'm not sure if it is a trend. The reason why I say that is because I think that there is still this need to have books as, like, you know, a thing separate from, like, the rest of the box set. Like, you know, I think that consumers really like having books, like having, like, you know, something that they can carry around. That's just like a simple thing that they can just keep in their bag versus a box set, which is like huge and it takes a lot of time. But for me, it's like, this is very precious because it's like, you know, we spend a lot of time and energy into it. And it's like, hopefully it shows to, you know, to the customer. But for me, it's just like, you know, I really enjoy opening a box and seeing all the different ephemera, all the different things that are part of the game. So I think I enjoy doing it. I enjoy, you know, seeing box sets out there. But for the average customer, I'm not sure if they all enjoy it. I'm not sure if that's a trend that's going to happen just yet.
It's funny because I kind of feel the same way as you were. When the first time I saw like a box game, I was like, oh no, I like the book. The book feels like a cool thing to put on my shelf. But then I feel like two things happened. We got sent a copy of Story Brewer's Fight with Spirit, and which is like a high school sports drama role-playing game. And I opened up the box. I was like, this is cool. Like, I liked digging through it in a way that I didn't think I would. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm also, this is slightly different, but ravenous to get the physical copy of Eusebius Ben Breakfast, which is like kind of skirting the line between those two.
Totally.
I'm like, it is cool, but like, I do like the book, but it is cool to have the ephemera. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing because one of the things we've talked about, not so much on this podcast, but I guess on My First Dungeon, is we played Tin Candles a couple times, once for our main feed and once for Patreon. We had a chat with Stephen Dewey, who I think is a friend of yours.
Yes.
And Stephen talked a lot about ritual and the power of ritual in tabletop role-playing games. And I feel like what a box set does is like forces you into a ritual space by the nature of like unpacking the box and setting it up and following those instructions in the way that like every board game is a ritual, but then it sort of is getting you into this role-playing space of the game. So love that.
I just had a thought. What if we, now I'm just thinking of game designer brain. What if we made a game that was a box set, but the by unpacking it, those were the mechanics by which you played the game.
Oh.
Like by the time you fully unpacked it, the game was over.
The game's over. Ugh.
That's
or
fine.
Or maybe the game's over when you after you fully repack it.
Delete
it's
that.
Like,
we're
it's
not
like
putting
10
that out
candles
on.
Every time you pull something out. This is an idea. This is a good
idea.
I like
that's
this
a fun
one.
Idea.
That's good. That's
okay, I'm
going to
sit on that.
Especially because of the well, the first half of the game is pulling everything out, and the second half is putting it all back in extremely neatly.
Because there's nothing I like more than like
nothing I like more
a
than
game that has all the pieces
the
that go into perfect space.
It's so good.
That'd be fun because then you could like choose which piece. Like, there's a bunch of ephemera that you could like choose. Like, you can pick this meeple or this die, and depending on which one you pick, you get different things. This is a good idea.
Did you ever play that penguin game with like the flicking?
Don't
the
break the ice.
Yes.
Oh no.
Wait, is it break the ice or don't break the ice?
Where you're hammering the box of bricks of ice? Oh
no,
no.
It's like
I'm
the one where
else.
You're like flicking the penguins. And it's like a I can't remember the name of the game. It won a bunch of awards like many years ago.
Oh, it sounds lovely. Flicking penguins?
Yeah,
I'm in.
You're flicking penguins and you're trying to get them through like little spaces in like several boxes. And the box opening experience is so good because it's so satisfying to like fit all these different rooms.
Ooh, ice cool.
That's the one. Yes.
This looks very fun.
It's very fun.
You know, I know a lot of people have a lot of bad things to say about Apple, but I'll say one thing for them. The box opening experience on anything Apple is really good. They nailed that.
Yeah. Oh, then there's sorry, I'm this is my last thing I'm going to say on this little game design brain blast.
Go for it.
Is the game should be like corporate horror-y about like an Apple kind of company.
Oh, like, that's good.
Like it's
that's
like
good,
you are it's like very overly corporate.
You are a product tester or you're a product placement. Yeah, there's something good here.
There's some good stuff here.
Ultimate
anyway,
box opening experience.
We're not here to make a new game. We're
we'll
here
add
to talk
to the
about
production calendar. So what were we talking about?
I forgot.
Who are you? So when you're thinking about what you're going to be making next, are you wanting to keep making more games like that? Or are you, I know that you just made a solo game, which is decidedly the just book side of these games, but do you have a direction you'd prefer to go in as you make more games?
Honestly, at this point, I think I'm more interested in making things that I'm excited for. And so yeah, like the solo journaling stuff, like that's stuff that I'm really excited for because it is a solo experience. It's very, you know, it's very much in that vein of isolation when it comes to horror. Like you're sort of isolated. You're thinking about like, you know, the stuff that you're journaling down. And I think that as I get it's sort of like that weird meme. Have you seen that meme where it's like, you know, the first one is like a brain exploding and then the second one is like the brain exploding even more. And then the third one is just like galaxy brain. I feel like the first one was just like, for me, it was like, you know, I want to learn everything about game design. I got to make something that's like overly complicated and just like fit everything in. And the second one is like, maybe it doesn't have to be too complicated. Maybe it just has to be like, you know, a bunch of pieces. And then the third one's just like, I give up. Like, I just want to make something cool and for myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And then it the fourth one is the, what's the one word RPG? We Are But Worms. Have you seen that?
Yeah, exactly like that. Yeah.
What is the one word?
The one word is writhe.
Oh, very good. Very good.
Yeah.
It does seem to be like the arc of creativity for, I think just like across mediums is like you try the big thing, You try the successful thing, and then you just get the super specific thing that is exactly the thing that you want.
Right, exactly.
Simple is hard.
Simple is hard.
Yeah,
it can be for sure.
Can be.
Yeah. There's this brilliant game called Still Life. It's a LARP where you're playing rocks, and you're just like hanging out as rocks, and time passes. There's a GM, and the GM will tell you that time passes, you know, seasons pass, things happen. You as a rock get carried down a river to another spot that, you know, the other players are playing at. And yeah, that's the entire game. You're just like hanging out as rocks. And it's brilliant. I love it.
That rules.
I've never really tried a LARP.
I haven't either, actually.
I've read a little bit, but I think the closest I've done to a LARP is like the opening of a game of Die. And that was it.
Oh. Mm. Yeah, I feel like I get the feeling that both of you would like it.
What?
Yes.
What?
Game podcasters and/or designers.
I mean, there is that theatrical element to it, right? Like, I think that a lot of people, when they think about LARPs, they think, you know, Fireball or was it Lightning Bolt? but I think that, you know, they're
the classic trick.
There's nothing wrong with a fireball.
No, there's nothing wrong with throwing a fireball.
You give me a sock ball and tell me to throw it at someone and it kills them? Absolutely no notes.
Yeah, absolutely nothing wrong with it. But there's like other types of LARPs, right? So there's like Nordic LARPs, American freeform LARPs. I tend to go towards American freeform just because it's easier to play, faster to play, and it's built around a convention setting. And so that's the type of LARP that I really enjoy.
I got to tell you that the thing I read today in Suburban Consumption that made me go, oh, I need to try a LARP was What Lies Beneath, which is one of the group LARPs.
Yeah.
Brian, I don't think I told you about this one when we were talking earlier. A family sits down to a normal dinner absent the youngest who has recently died. There is a monster beneath the table and there are secrets that no one dares to say. Through the influence of the monster, secrets are revealed until the family is taken over by its presence. One person sits under the table as the monster and like signals the family to like be possessed and reveal their secrets and scratch their legs. It's so gnarly and Oh, I read it and I was like, yep, need to do that.
Sadia designed that and I play tested it and it was the person sitting under the table just like sat there the entire time and like kept grabbing people's legs and stuff. It was so fun.
That is so fun. So fun.
That's wild. That also gets right into the there's this great line from Alfred Hitchcock that was like, if you shoot a conversation between two people at a table, they could say anything. And it's probably, and then a bomb goes off and it's like 10 seconds of suspense. But rather, if you start the same conversation, show the audience there's a bomb beneath the table and then have this conversation happen, you get like 10 minutes of suspense out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the first thing that triggers in my mind.
Absolutely. So forgery, I do want to dig in a little bit more on this because I heard you say in an interview that this is the first game that you're the only designer on.
Yes. So I think all of my other work has been with other people, and this is like the first time I'm actually just like doing it by myself.
That's so I find it's great. It's really different than what you hear most often about in TTRPGs. I feel like you hear people like make the small game by themselves, the slightly bigger game by themselves, and then they get to. So you came at this first as like a collaborator and a team member. And I guess I'm curious, do you think that has, like, changed your design sensibilities or, like, improved them in any ways? Like, how do you feel about kind of going into this first game as the only designer?
Yeah, I would say that, well, okay, a part of that is a lie. The first two games I designed were solo games, but they were LARPs. And those were, like, from ages ago. Those won Golden Cobra Challenge Awards, like, many, many years ago. But this one is like, I would say my first one in a very long time that I'm self-publishing and, you know, is in an actual book that's just me. And I think that over the course of time, I sort of want to like, you know, have some more space to explore and like do something that I'm really excited for. And I think while it was a lot of fun doing collaborations with other people, I think I'm getting to a point where I'm just like, I would like to do something that's just all me, except for like, you know, the art, you know, maybe the cover art or, you know, the editing or, you know, something with minimal project management.
Project management. I can say words. Project management is hard. And that's really the crux of the thought that was going to sound better. But my brain was on the fritz.
I was reading through Forgery today and it struck me that I've only read maybe four or five solo games kind of like cover to cover. And this struck me as much more, very much more like a choose your own adventure book than the more kind of vibes based effect of a lot of solo TTRPGs where it's like very open-ended questions. You're kind of moving through it. This felt much more story-based and very like specific story-based. I'm curious why that formatting interested you more than something like an Anamnesis that is very open-ended.
Yeah, there were a couple of things. I think the first thing is I really wanted to tell a specific story.
Good reason.
Yeah. I wanted it to be very much like, you know, it has prompts, but I did want that choose your own adventure, more streamlined story. And I wanted to have that energy of like an A24 movie, right? Like sort of that same sort of feel. And then the second thing is that this actually started as it happened simultaneously. It was both a game and a screenplay at the same time. And so I had the idea of, like, you know, wanting to make this into a screenplay. And so after I wrote my first iteration of the screenplay and, you know, finished publishing the game, I started chatting with Carlos Cisco, and we were going back and forth, and we created like a second iteration of the screenplay, which is much better than the first iteration, because I was just like, I don't know what I was doing. And so yeah, that was sort of what the thinking was going into it.
Is it still a screenplay? Is that still the
it
hope?
Is
Very cool.
We made a thing, and yeah, very excited for it. And now I'm working on the, well, it's going to be like a three-parter. It's not really a trilogy, but it's sort of like a trilogy in the sense that John Carpenter had a trilogy. So it's kind of like that, where it's going to be, the second one's going to be about fashion, and the third one is maybe about music. I'm still trying to figure out the mechanics for that. So
all solo games that are also screenplays.
Yes.
Very cool. Man, see, my brain is going to, like, you know, physical media for movies era of, like, having the DVD booklet be a solo game would be so cool.
That would be cool.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah. It's a shame we don't really sell DVDs anymore.
Yeah, it really is.
Media's going down the drain. It's a bummer.
Yeah. But not in TTRPGs. We're holding on. So as somebody who's kind of, you know, such a, like, natural collaborator, or went to collaboration first, the sort of codified form of collaboration is something we call a company, I guess, in the business worlds. And you founded one of those, Game and a Curry, recently renamed to Read Write Memory. Kind of what is the company at a broad level, if you just could tell us?
So it's evolved from what was initially, which was a blog about games and restaurants. And so when it first started, it was called Game and a Curry because Herb and I, my partner, we would always go to this one curry spot in New York, and we would play games there. And that was just sort of the thinking going in. And we were like, let's make a blog. And we would talk about games. And eventually that evolved into a publishing business where we were publishing our friends' games. And we were just testing the waters, you know, where we would take our friends' games and publish them, manufacture them over in China, and, you know, see what sticks. We didn't use Kickstarter. We didn't use any crowdfunding platform or anything like that, because the cost of manufacture at the time, this was pre-pandemic, at the time, it was probably about like $3,000 or $4,000. Like, it wasn't that much. And we were just like, let's just see what happens. We're doing 1,000 units. Let's see how it goes. And so that was our first game. It was called Yeah Diamonds. It was by Dave Beaver and Brian Soriano. And then from there, we luckily somehow got the license for Judge Dredd, and my partner created Judge Dredd Block War, which is like a card game. I know, I just realized that this is like not broad strokes anymore, but basically it's evolved over time. It started off as, like, you know, us testing out the water, seeing if we enjoy it. We enjoy it. Now let's take this more seriously. Let's, you know, actually think about, like, the stuff that we enjoy doing, the stuff that we want to make. And that's why it's now being renamed to Read Write Memory, because it's more focused on the types of games that we are excited for. Games that are very sarcastic, dark humor. You know, it also has, like, a horror element to it. Things that, you know, excite us when it comes to the themes.
I have to dig in on something you said there, where you said somehow we got the Judge Dredd license. I feel like that somehow has some more in there.
Yeah. So Herb and I, we were fans of Judge Dredd, mostly because, like, we were just, like, fans of the comic. Like, we really like that tongue-in-cheek, like, you know, dystopian universe type of setting. And so he had been making a game. He had, like, this game that was specifically made for Judge Dredd. And I was just like, the license is going to be a pain to get. Like, I don't know how we're going to do this. Like, you know, we've never done an IP before. Around the same time, I met with a lawyer who's a games lawyer. And we were chatting. And I was just like, so say we want to get a license for something. Like, what does that look like? He walked us through it. Previously, he had gotten the license for, I think it was Big Trouble in Little China. He got the license for Rambo and one more license. I think it was Terminator or something like that. And so he had experience doing this. And so we were chatting and I was like, hey, do you want to help us out? Try to get the license for Judge Dredd. Judge Dredd is owned by Rebellion. And so there was some communication there. We chatted a lot. We met on Zoom. You know, we got along. And next thing we knew, we had a license for Judge Dredd.
Amazing.
That's a good path.
Yeah. Lawyers.
They're good.
Lawyers are good.
Yeah.
Rom-Com Drama Bomb is a three-player, GM-less, asymmetrical TTRPG about me-cutes and mayhem. In this 90-minute timed game, you'll play as two people who shouldn't fall in love and the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do. Rom-Com Drama Bomb is now available. You can grab it digitally at moreblueberries.itch.io/romcom, or you can grab a physical book, the pinkest book you've ever seen, at moreblueberries.shop/romcom. Check it out and happy rom-comming. Rom-comming? I don't know. Drama bombing?
Speak into the void. You never know who may be listening. In the Annie Award-winning Void 1680 AM, you take on the role of a late-night radio DJ. Use a standard poker deck and a six-sided die to build your playlist, interact with callers, and assemble a show that expresses something about why you love the music that you do. Void 1680 AM includes rules for single session and ongoing play, so you can develop the relationships of your DJ with your callers over time. You can even join the growing community of affiliate DJs whose shows are broadcast live on air and on YouTube. Shop Void 1680 AM now at bannerless.games/shop and take 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON. Again, that's 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON.
As far as the projects that you have coming out in the near future, is there anything you'd want to preview of like the type of things that you're hoping to create?
Yes. So there are three games that are coming out soon. So in terms of like what we're publishing my partner's game, which is called Human OS. So it's the system. Human OS is it's so sarcastic. It's just like, it's like The Sims. Like imagine The Sims, but you're playing it as a TTRPG and like anything can happen. It's very like open-ended. It's kind of like Paranoia. It's got like that weird, like sarcastic, like dystopian feel to it. That's his thing. It's got cults. It's got like a whole lot of different stuff in it. But for me, I'm working on two games. The first one is called Knockoff, which is the sequel to Forgery. It uses the same sort of like system where it's, you know, very much like a choose your own adventure type of thing. You have like ephemera after you complete the game. But instead of coloring, instead of the paint by numbers thing, you're now cutting out pieces of fabric or of patterns, and you're pasting it over a croquis. So it's like a model that you're pasting it over. So you're creating your own dress, essentially, is what's going on. Yeah, same sort of like feel, same sort of vibe, where it's very, it's about professional jealousy. It's about, you know, trying to be successful in like a creative industry. And that also has a lot of content warnings. It's a lot gorier than the first one. A lot of body horror, like Hannibal level body horror.
That was my first. I was like, okay, it puts lotion on its skin.
Yeah. And then the second game I'm hoping to put out soon is sort of like an analog horror type of game where it's called The Darkness at the Brink of Ohio. And it is about a radio DJ that basically plays a song, and it's a cursed song, and he becomes this other type of thing. It's like this cursed song takes a hold of him and turns him into something else. Like his everything that he had like pent up, like all of the terrible things that he had been like thinking about, that sort of like gets revealed over time. So that's like the artifact that you're listening to, and it's a radio show. So as you're listening to it, you're journaling and reacting to it. And it's about parasocial relationships. It's about, you know, both on both ends, right? So it's parasocial relationships on the audience's end where it's like, you know, I love this DJ. This is the one DJ that I listen to during my day job because, you know, I work late nights and basically worship this guy. And for the DJ himself, it's like two things are happening. The first thing is like, you know, I'm feeling kind of weird about my fans because they might cross boundaries that I'm not comfortable with. But at the same time, I don't have anything else going on because I'm a small-time DJ. No one else is listening to me. I'm sort of like a micro celebrity in my town. And so I have to keep doing this. So it's testing out like analog horror for a bit and seeing how that goes in like a tabletop space. And it's also very much like inspired by Void. It's inspired by Ribbon Drive. A lot of like the sound-based games that are out there right now.
Is this something for that one? Is that you're creating a playlist or is that you're reacting to a playlist?
You're reacting to a playlist. So the playlist is already created. I have some voiceover actors that are giving me their voice samples or voices to this project. So Aaron Catano Sayas is one of the, he's playing the DJ. So like the DJ Mark is what he's called. So he's doing the voice for the main character. Jasmine Bular is doing like the little bumpers. We have Danny Quatch, Austin Taylor, who's doing the callers. And then we have like this weird parasite that calls, who is from like an actor that I need to get clearance from to announce just because he's kind of a big deal. And so I got to talk to him first before like, you know, announcing.
Hell yeah.
But very excited for that. And some of the music that we have two songs that are licensed from artists who are in the game space as well. So we have Mabel Harper, who's doing one song, and then we have Amar Starr, who's doing the second song. So very excited.
Hell yeah. That's very cool.
Really cool. Yeah. I'm curious, how are you distributing the audio? Is that going to be publicly available audio, like on Spotify? And are you putting it out as a podcast, or how are you doing that? Yeah.
So two things. We're going to be releasing it on YouTube, so that way anyone can just like freely find it and just listen to it. You know, the game part of it is going to be like the thing that people are paying for, right? Like the book. But the audio is just going to be like free to download, free to stream. And we're also going to be putting it on our radio station. So Herb, my partner, he does like a lot of radio stuff. We're hopefully going to be able to put that on at a certain time because the radio show actually happens between 3 to 4 a.m. in game. And so he's going to do the same thing by just putting it out there on like 3 to 4 a.m. PST.
That's the way to play it.
Yeah.
Is to tune into the 3 to 4 a.m.
Play
of it. It's wild to make like a solo game a event, like event watching or like event activity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had a conversation not too long ago with Jay Stroutman talking about how solo games don't necessarily need to be alone. Like you could play them as a group, you could play them in teams. And it's, we hadn't considered the idea of playing solo games together but separately.
New avenue.
The book itself has three different characters that you can choose from in terms of like who you want to play as you're journaling. And so one of my best friends, she's a lab technician and she works from 10 p.m. 10 to 9 a.m. I don't know. She starts at 10 p.m., which is like the weirdest thing. And so she's actually written as one of the characters that you can play as. She's just a lab technician. That's basically what it is, where it's just like, you know, you're a lab technician, or you can play as like a gas station attendant, or you can play as a security guard, just like guarding a corporate building.
Wild.
I will say I used to work overnight shifts at a radio station. And there is something truly transcendent about leaving work at 7 a.m. and taking the train into Brooklyn when the entire rest of the world is on their way starting the day. And your path is completely clear and everyone else is miserable as you're going home.
Oof. That must be interesting.
That's a very flavorful moment you just described.
It's great. It was beautiful.
So I want to talk a bit more about like collaboration and kind of expanding on that, because like, I think you've had a lot of different versions of that, big, small, you know, for corporations, for other people, or like what broadly makes for a successful collaboration for you?
I think, broadly speaking, I think that the most success I've seen before And now when it comes to, you know, collaborations and stuff, like the best thing to do is just having visibility. And so making sure that everyone on the project, on the team can see what the end result is going to be. And so like having that clear vision for the entire team is really good. Having a clear, you know, clear understanding of like what the tasks are is really important as well. And I like having small teams. And I mean, this is me speaking as someone who has like agile certification. And so like, I'm talking a little bit as like a scrum master right now, but just like having a small team that can like easily see everything that's going on and having like a central location to put all of your information is really important. Cause I think that this seems like it's very simple, but like a lot of companies, a lot of teams, they forget to do that. And they have like information just like scattered all over the place. But having one space to have your source of truth, all of your information, having like, you know, like a way to connect with one another via either like, you know, Discord or Slack or whatever, like having that space is really important.
Just to kind of touch on that a little bit more, what are the tools that you use most that you think designers and people who begin to work in teams would most benefit from?
Yeah, I think that for the contractor or freelancer that doesn't want to spend any money, Google Drive is amazing. So having, yeah, like Google Docs, having PowerPoint, like on Google, I don't know what it's called, Google Slides.
Google Slides.
Yeah, Google Slides, that's the one, is really great because I think that Google Slides really helps you visualize everything. So like if you wanted to, if you had like an idea for something, then you could just like quickly just draw it out, sketch it out, and you can show it to other people. When it comes to like more of the COGS side of the cost of goods sold or timelines or, you know, project management stuff, you know, spreadsheets is great or Sheets is great. Notion is also great when it comes to project management. What else do people use? I use this at work. Shoot. Like Kanban boards, right? So
Trello.
Trello, that's the one. Good, yes. Yeah. I was just like, what's the name? It starts with a T. Trello is great to keep track of everything. And so those are some of the tools I use. I prefer Slack over Discord just because you can pin things and you don't have to pay. I mean, the version I use because I piggyback off of my company's Slack. you know, perfect. I don't have to like pay for, you know, pinning Slacks or pay for, I don't know, whatever it is that you typically need to pay for. So those are the tools that I would recommend. And I think that when it comes to like mocking up mood boards and stuff, like Canva's great, Slides is great. We do a lot of prototyping through Slides. Like during the pandemic, a lot of our work was done through Slides when it came to prototyping and testing and iteration and playtesting. Like all of that stuff was done through Slides. Tabletop Simulator was pretty decent at stuff too, but the biggest issue that we found with Tabletop Simulator is that there is a learning curve. And so when you have like new players that don't know how to use Tabletop Simulator, it takes up like a whole half hour just to teach them how to use it.
And as part of the experience then informs their playtest experience. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that was a little bit trickier for us, but we did do a lot of playtesting through Tabletop Simulator when it came to board games. So,
and then I guess on the flip side of like of the collaboration question, when someone is approaching you to work on something, what makes it like an automatic yes for you? I mean, other than when the money's good.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely one of the three things I think about, right? Like money is definitely a factor. The second is like, you know, scope. Like if it's clear, then yes, I'll take it. If it's like sort of like wishy-washy, I'd be a little bit more hesitant. And also if I'm interested in it, like I think that sometimes I get approached because, you know, in the past, I've done a lot of different types of writing, like a lot of styles of writing, a lot of different styles of game design as well, using different themes. And I think that sometimes people approach me with questions like, hey, like, you know, would you ever want to do a game about like a cozy game? And I'm like, I'm not a cozy type of person. And, you know, maybe I've done it in the past. Maybe I've written, you know, cozy games in the past. But that was more because like I was building up my portfolio. I was just starting out. And now I want to focus more on the things I'm interested in, which are typically darker in theme.
And I guess like the self-serving question that I also want to ask is that you've obviously worked on a lot of like large gigs, and as a freelancer, like, what are your sort of tips for going after the gigs of the likes that you've had?
Yeah, I think that networking was really important for me. I think that, as an example, for Betrayal, I got that gig through my friend Brian Neff. And so Brian and I, we had been friends for a while. We sort of started around like the same space where it's just like, okay, like, you know, Brian was doing a lot of game development for other companies. I had just started doing like my own design, you know, writing for other companies. And so we started chatting, we were hanging out, and he was like, hey, I have this gig coming up for Betrayal Scooby-Doo. Would you be interested in doing something for it? And I was like, hell yes. Yes, absolutely. Like, I will definitely do that and build my resume and this will look good. And so the mindset going in was like, A, it's going to be good for my resume, and B, later on down the line, maybe we'll do another Betrayal. Who knows? Because yeah. Betrayal games are sort of like evergreen, right? And so after that, he was like, hey, like, I'm putting together a team for Betrayal 3rd edition. Like, hey, do you want to be a part of it? And I was like, yes. And I also want to bring on my friend, because you gave me that opportunity. I want to pass it on to like a friend who would be interested in writing for Betrayal. And so it's sort of like that idea of like, you know, if a friend does something nice for you, then try to bring along another friend and, you know, bring as many people as you like into the industry as possible.
Yeah. Network forward and back.
Yeah, exactly.
Are there any, just from your perspective, are there any properties or games that you would like to work on in the future that like you're hoping to get onto in some capacity?
Oof. That's a hard question. I'm in this time right now where I think, I hope I don't sound arrogant. I really like movies and I really like TV. But I like that they are their own thing. I like seeing those properties as the medium that they are created in. And I love them for what they are. And I don't want to, I don't think that I should be the person to create like a game for it, because then it would be a different experience. And that would sort of tamper with, you know, my experience of the IP that I enjoy so much. And so I think for now, I'm more focused on creating my own games and my own stories rather than work on someone else's and, like, you know, potentially make something and in the process sort of like change the way that I enjoy the media.
Right.
Does that make sense?
That's yeah. A good answer.
Like, if you'd have to watch every frame of the movie you're adapting 20 times and then you wouldn't like it anymore.
Right, exactly. Like with Scooby, yeah. I had to like watch every single episode of Who Are You? Or Where Are You? Not Who Are You? Where Are You? And it was just like, this was a fun experience. It was a lot of fun. But at the same time, I feel like it's just, I think that was like a time where I was just like, I'm having a lot of fun now, but now I'm just like,
now, if you watch Scooby-Doo, different. You're like thinking about betrayal mechanics while you're watching.
Right, exactly.
The episode.
Yeah. Exactly.
I get that.
That makes sense. So a couple questions I want to ask about just like your perspective on the TTRPG industry specifically, which is one of these sort of three industries within games you work in. I'm curious if there are any designers, companies, or design trends within the space that are always something that like you are paying attention to that piques your interest, that will like always get your attention.
Yeah, I think that before the pandemic, I was really excited for live action online games because it took the medium of, it could be like a phone or text messaging or like that sort of medium, and trying to implement that into like a tabletop role-playing game or a tabletop, or even like a live, like a LARP, right? And so I thought that was really interesting. I'm excited to see more of that. Like, that's something that I'm just like hungry for all the time, because it was strange that it happened before the pandemic. And then during the pandemic, it was kind of quiet when it came to live action online games, or at least I haven't seen that many. like now we're in 2024, like I'm hoping that there would be more of that. Because Alice is Missing was definitely something that came out of, it was designed pre-pandemic, right? So a lot of like the publishing happened during the pandemic. You know, that's sort of like when it was manufactured and that's when it came out. But I wonder if there could be, maybe like people are doing it right now. Maybe people are like designing games right now that are like, you know, implementing the use of digital technologies within within tabletop stuff. And it's very different, right? Like it's very different when I'm talking about like digital technologies for role-playing versus like something like Roll20. Like Roll20 is right. like a different thing. That's like a, that's just like, you know, something to
You're
help
You're saying
you.
Like existing digital tools, using them as like the medium of play.
Right, like ViewScreen. Like yeah. play, like using that as like a part of the game.
Are you familiar with This Discord Has Ghosts in It?
Yes.
Yeah, I wonder if they developed that during the pandemic. I'm not actually sure that the original design timeline on that, but
yeah.
that feels like a pandemic design.
That's true. Maybe that was during the pandemic because it came out like close to the beginning. I want to say like 2020, 2021.
Yeah, the first
2021.
First yeah. edition. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that is interesting. It seems like that would be, you're right. That is sort of surprising that like the pandemic didn't spawn, you know, 50 of those.
But maybe folks were writing, you know, ideas and like, you know, creating stuff during that time. And we're probably going to see it.
We're going to see them soon.
Yeah, we're probably going to see them all like this year or next year.
Yeah. the other industry perspective question I wanted to ask you is if you think that there is like from working across a few different verticals, I guess, of games business, is there a big business lesson that you think TTRPGs needs to learn or could stand to learn?
That's a good question. I think accessibility is still the biggest one. Tabletop role-playing games are still not as... And I mean, I think that there are all these other games, right, that are very accessible. People enjoy purchasing them. People enjoy playing them, such as, like, you know, TCGs, party games, those kinds of different mediums. Like, I feel like those are very accessible. And I don't think that the way that RPGs are framed right now is as accessible as those games. However, with that being said, I think that there is opportunity for a TTRPG to say, like, we're like a party game and like frame it that way so that like a mass market audience would understand and be like, oh, I'll pick this up. And unknowingly experience a LARP and like get really excited for it or like a, you know, a light tabletop role-playing game. Because I think that the more accessible that you make something, the more fans that you'll get into the game and or the genre and medium. It's not a genre, it's a medium. and the more, you know, fans that you get into the medium, the more likely they're going to try like other games as well. So I think that while D&D is very popular, I don't think it's very accessible. And I think it makes more sense to create something that's very accessible, frame it as like a party game or like a board game or something like that, and then watch people get excited for more types of games like it.
We're doing a guerrilla role playing in our games.
Yeah, exactly. Ooh.
Yeah, we're gonna sneak it in.
Yeah, sneak yeah. those veggies in.
Yeah, yeah, right. Even framing it as improv would be easier than like saying yeah. we're gonna play D&D.
I feel like Fiasco kind of did that pretty well. Like, that's a game that I see more
yeah,
regularly.
The box set, especially. Yeah,
the box set, because originally, like, the book was very much role playing game, but then the box set kind of feels like a party game that you're storytelling, and it's like it's only one step removed to role play it.
And honestly, the games you're doing have that same, like, just the visual cue even of the production from, like, a purchasability perspective gets board game people, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's interesting.
It's surprising how anytime, like, I share, like, board game, or sorry, a specific type of role-playing game with, like, board gamers, like, storytelling games they really enjoy versus, like, role-playing, like, actual role-playing, it seems like... And this is all anecdotal, so don't just take this with a grain of salt. Anytime I play like a story storytelling game or something that's like a world building game where you're like, you know, building out worlds based on like questions and prompts and things like that. It's a lot more accessible to like a board game audience versus like, you know, trying to act out a character, which I found kind of interesting.
Interesting.
This is where our unpack the box, repack the box game comes in. This is where the full circle.
Yeah.
There's the market.
Yes, we found it.
You're it's building not a corporation. Good,
it's profitable. Very confusing. As we kind of start winding down this conversation, there are some questions we always like to ask our guests kind of more about themselves. And one of them is like, when you're not designing, when you're not making games, what do you like to play and read? And what do you find yourself consistently inspired by?
I'm like looking at my stack of books right now.
That's literally what I do when I get asked this question. I just look around the room like, what do I want for Christmas?
Yeah. I like to read a lot of different types of books. Right now I'll just show it to you. Or wait, no, this is a podcast. I can't show it to you. So I'm reading.
You show us.
So I'm reading, the Ring book right now. It's based like the, you know, the Ring movie, like the Ring book. I don't know which came first, but I'm reading the Ring movie book. I don't know which one came first. So I'm just like, I don't know, maybe it's the Ring movie that came first and then they wrote a book, or maybe it's the other way around. But I'm reading that. I'm also reading Stella's De Minorum, which is about like a bunch of like, you know, just like demons and like magic and, you know, different spirits and stuff. It's interesting because the way that they frame it is that the way that they frame magic is a ritual that one person does. I'm butchering the quote. This is not the quote at all, but the way that they frame it is this, like, you know, a person, it's like a solo game, basically. Like the way that they said it was just like, oh, in my mind, this sounds like a solo game because you're sort of embodying this character and you are performing this this ritual, and that's pretty much it. It's like a solo performance and it's self-serving. It's like, you know, for yourself and no one else is watching. And then they go on to say, this is a very boring way of describing magic, we understand, but that's basically what it is. That's what, you know, rituals are. That's what, you know, magic is. And I'm also reading, and this is like the third time I'm going through it, or trying to go through it, is The Tao of Craft by Benabel Wen, which is like How to Craft Talismans, Sigils, and Esoteric Taoism type of stuff.
For the listening audience, that one has many sticky notes sticking out of it.
And then in terms of movies and stuff, mostly horror movies. It's all horror movies all the time.
That tracks.
And cults.
So, Banana, we always like to end the show with our question, what are you bringing to the table? And this is a recommendation to our listeners. It could be a person, a game, a show, a resource. It could be tabletop related. It could be not tabletop related at all. But just one recommendation for our audience that
just
we would give
one.
Today.
Yeah. Or whatever you're excited about right now.
Okay. I am very excited for Brother Son, which is a Netflix show. It's about a couple of brothers. They're Chinese American, and one of them grew up in Taiwan and grew up with like a dad who worked for the triads. And one day, I'm not going to give away too many spoilers, but one day he has to go to the U.S., go to L.A. to find his brother and mother who have moved away and try to protect them from this big, triad fiasco that's going on. And the other brother, the younger brother who lives in L.A., has no idea any of this is happening, has no idea anything about, like, you know, his family's history or, you know, what they do. And so he's kind of like the fish out of water sort of character. And yeah, it's a lot of fun, very well written. I love that show a lot. In terms of games, I would say for TTRPGs, I'm very excited for Triangle Agency. Like, that's the one game I really, really want to get onto the table.
We're excited about that too.
Yeah. And board games, I love Rebuilding Seattle. That was so much fun.
Thank you so much, Banana Chan, for coming to the table today. Do you want to let people know where they can find you?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. You can find me on all the social media at Banana Chan Games. You can find my company, Read Write Memory, aka Game in a Curry, at Game in a Curry, on all the social media except for Instagram, which is now Read Write Memory Games. And our website is www.gameinacurry.com.
If you want more gaming content from us, you can check out the 20-sided newsletter and the many-sided media Discord server. Those are both linked in the show notes below. Rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what The Table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.